From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's the Week in Review, including Aaron Hernandez, brain injuries in football, President Trump at the UN, and the latest push to roll back Obamacare.
Graham Cassidy would be, as it's currently conceived, would be a huge problem for the Commonwealth of Mass, and it's my hope that it doesn't pass.
Also today, CBS is boldly going where no broadcast TV network has gone before.
Change is the essential process of all existence. You must challenge your preconceptions, or they most certainly will challenge you.
We are creating a new way to fly.
They've got a new way to watch the new Star Trek Discovery series. The broadcast network is putting the series exclusively online. Plus, it's fall in New England. Amy Traverso of Yankee Magazine helps us celebrate the coming of cider, fall color, and some lesser-known hidden joys of the season. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday and time for the Week in Review, and we'll start today with news about brain injuries and football.
Aaron Hernandez had an advanced stage 3 of CTE, which is usually found in the median age of a 67-year-old man. It was the most severe case they had ever seen for someone of Aaron's age.
That was the announcement made yesterday by Jose Baez, lawyer for family members of the former Patriots tight end Hernandez, killed himself in prison while serving a life sentence for murder. This morning, Patriots coach Bill Belichick said this about his team's role in informing players of the dangers of CTE.
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a trainer. I'm a coach. So the medical department is, they handle the medical part of it. That I don't do that.
Now, the news about Hernandez's brain comes in the same week that Boston University researchers released a new study on what happens to the brains of people who played tackle football before the age of 12, and it's not good. Here's Dr. Robert Stern from BU's CTE Center.
Am I at a point to say kids shouldn't be hitting their heads repeatedly until a certain age? Yeah, I'm there. Doesn't it just make sense that we try to keep their brains from getting hit hundreds of times per season?
There's much to discuss, and joining us today is Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, it's good to see you again.
Same here.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Hi there, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so I should say CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that is the disease that Aaron Hernandez was posthumously diagnosed with, because you can't figure out who has it while people are alive. But Tom, let's just start with you. Give us your reaction to the fact that apparently, according to his lawyer, Aaron Hernandez had an advanced stage of the disease.
So, you know, the thing that jumps to mind here, of course, is that Aaron Hernandez had been convicted of murder and was in prison for life. And to be convicted of murder requires that you in some fashion be found culpable, mm-hmm. that you are responsible for your own behavior. And one of the implications of this, which I'm sure the NFL is going to vigorously dispute, is that potentially the CTE actually made it so that Hernandez was not responsible or in control of his own behaviors, and particularly because it appears that CTE really ends up affecting impulse control.
Yeah. Well, to that point, Hernandez's family's lawyer, just to remind folks, has filed a lawsuit on behalf of his daughter. And they claim in the lawsuit that the Patriots and the NFL were, quote, fully aware of the damage that could be inflicted from repetitive impact injuries to the head. Now, just today, though, the NFL told the Globe that they, of course, intend to contest that claim vigorously, and that Hernandez's, quote, well-documented behavioral issues began long before he played in the NFL. So that's going to be an ongoing battle there. I mean, Arlene, what's your take?
Well, you know, even before getting to the issue of the lawsuit, when you think about CTE, which, because I can't pronounce it quickly enough, I'm just going to call it CTE, the notion that a disease that can cause violent mood swings, impulse control, aggressiveness, depression, suicide, is so clearly now connected to repeated concussions or even less than concussions is profound and frightening. And the fact that Hernandez had not just any old case, as though any old case would be bad enough, but he had a particularly severe one, that he said his 27-year-old brain looked as bad as a 67-year-old brain, is stunning. I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, you know, so it's interesting because to get back to what you were saying, Tom, and actually also you, Arlene, we've had a lot of discussion and a lot of studies that link CTE to things like depression and other cognitive impacts. But this is the first case in which there was a crime was committed, and as Tom, you were saying, now the lawyers are asking, like, could this possibly have been a factor? Problem, of course, is you can't diagnose CTE while a person is alive. But to that note, I mean, Boston defense attorney Phil Tracy, not involved at all with the Hernandez case, but offered his legal analysis to Channel 4, CBS Boston, about the lawsuit against the NFL and the Patriots by Hernandez's lawyer. And here's what Phil Tracy had to say.
I don't see how they can prove it. Unless you had a smoking gun where somebody said, Aaron Hernandez's brain is cooked, and telling Belichick and Kraft and the staff, you don't have that. You know, that's not there. There's no way you can connect the dots, so to speak, to say that it's the NFL's fault or it's the Patriots' fault that he got CTE.
Tom, what's your take?
So probably correct, okay? He only played for the NFL for 3 years. And he played football well prior to that, college, high school, mm-hmm. and so on. So all the NFL has to do is show that it could have happened in any of those other years and they're not responsible. But I don't think that's what this lawsuit's really about. The lawsuit isn't about the NFL. It's about football in general. And I think that's actually one of the things that's going to drive the NFL to eventually try to settle this case rather than have the trial painted across newspapers everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you really think that they'll try to settle? Because I think the other thing that we've been hearing over the past several years is that the concern is with the cumulative effects, right, of these repeated hits. And Arlene, as you were saying, even the subconcussive impacts.
Well, that's what's particularly disturbing, because as a parent of kids who were involved in sports, I always worried about concussions and never really thought through what now seems kind of obvious, that you don't have to reach as serious a condition as a concussion for it to be dangerous to the brain. And the notion that that the NFL might have known more than any of us did, that the notion that they may have concealed or misrepresented the risks of repeated traumatic impacts to NFL players is disgraceful.
Yeah.
Shame on them, because the only reason they'd be doing it, they may say they're doing it for the sport, they were doing it for the money.
You know what this is going to look like? It's going to look like the tobacco companies
fighting
the charges of cigarettes being dangerous.
Mm.
And they're going to do every trick in the book to try to make it so that the studies don't prove it. You don't have a certain length. It could be something else. And they will push and push and push until eventually, I think, the evidence will become overwhelming. And we're all going to look back and wonder, how on earth is we ever allowed this to happen?
Well, and interestingly, because I think the NFL now finds itself in a very, very difficult position that any other league that isn't as popular as the NFL would have a hard time recovering from. And that is that on the one hand, it can say, well, you know, it's not the NFL that's a problem, because there's all these other studies that point to the fact that, you know, early impacts on kids in Pop Warner, for example, can start leading to issues later in life. We'll talk about that study that just came out this week as well. But then again, they can't do that either, because no matter what, it's football as a whole that's getting maligned. And
exactly. And not only that, but the peak of football, which is the NFL, depends upon player development from a very early age.
Yes.
If the young kids don't get involved, then you really don't have the same quality product, if you will, that's going to be on the professional fields.
Yeah. So we talked to Dr. Robert Stern from Boston University, who was one of the lead authors of this other study that happened to also come out this week, earlier this week, where they looked at emotional regulation and cognitive function in folks in their 50s who had played football before the age of 12. And they found that those folks were 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer from difficulties in middle age. And I asked Dr. Stern, okay, so is it time for parents to stop letting their kids play tackle football? And he answered it in this way, that he had spoken to a former Super Bowl champion, didn't provide the person's name, and this player happens to have all daughters now. But Stern nevertheless asked him a question, and here's what he said.
If you had a son or if you had a daughter that wanted to play,
would you allow one of your kids to play youth tackle football? And here's someone who absolutely loved the game. He played 20 years of football. It was his life. And he very strongly and clearly answered, I don't know what all the answers are scientifically. We're not there yet. There's still so much to be done. So for me, the answer is delay it as much as possible.
And that's from, you know, secondhand, but it's from a former Super Bowl champ.
I can't believe Tom Brady said that.
Well, Tom Brady doesn't only have daughters, right? But
that speaks volumes. That tells you a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that Tom is right that, not Brady, but Keane, that people will look back in 10, 15 years, and not only will they be incredulous, but I think the children of some of these NFL folks are going to turn to their parents in 20 years and say, "What did you do, Dad? Why did you why didn't you say something? Why didn't you do something? Why did you let it go on and let all these people get
And
hurt?
Why did you let me play?" That's going to be the question. Why did you let me play knowing these dangers? I'm just a kid.
Yeah. You know, so here we are in eastern Massachusetts where, you know, maybe some kids have lots of different options for various team sports that they can and want to play. Of course, football still being very popular amongst those. But what I really wonder is how the cumulative effect of these studies and this news about football's impact on the brain, what effect that's having in places where football is basically like a religion, you know, in other parts of the country where it's almost indistinguishable from, you know, from regular school culture itself. Do you think that that there are attitude changes there possible?
Yeah, I think it may be that people who are fans of Donald Trump, just nothing will change their mind, you know, and that's sort of like on football. There are people who are such fanatics for football that it's going to take an awful long time and a lot of evidence. And right now, they're going to believe the NFL and football advocates who say the evidence just isn't there. You know, we can make some minor changes and you don't have to worry about it.
There's a little bit of the money monkey, no see, no, you know, no hear, where whether it was dogfights that people now don't approve of because they know how cruel they are, or if we can harken back several hundred thousand, whatever years to the fights in the Colosseum, you know, they were great entertainment, I'm sure, for the people who got to watch them. But we would never consider them today, right? Because, you know, things that are dangerous are just not appropriate to be entertained by. So if people want to choose to do it, so be it. But the NFL should be honest.
Well, so here's my pushback. Because a couple of years ago, I visited a high school and watched a high school football practice. And they spent a lot of time there being very careful about how the young men were tackling each other. Half the practice that I witnessed was all about adjusting tackle technique so that, you know, it wasn't head-to-head or even like just a full-on sort of battering ram. They were dropping shoulders. They were being very conscientious about teaching safer ways to tackle. And that's worked itself all the way down to, you know, the Pop Warner level, making a lot of changes there. Plus, folks say, there's disagreement about this, but some folks say the equipment is better too. So is it possible that those kinds of adjustments could make a positive difference so that the risks to the head are reduced?
So here's the pushback to that, and that is the subconcussive problem, which is that it definitely is possible, I think, to use equipment and technique to reduce the risk of concussion. And certainly now the concussion protocols are in place so that if someone does have the appearance of a concussion, you pull them out, you really make sure that they're fully recovered from the concussion before going back. But the really big problem here is the subconcussive stuff, where it's just the rocking back and forth of the brain very, very quickly within the skull that can cause this kind of damage. And if the evidence continues to show that it's subconcussive that causes the damage here, then I'm not sure how you solve that problem.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's move on, if we can, to other news of the week. This has to do with healthcare writ large across the nation, and that's specifically the Graham-Cassidy bill. It's the latest attempt by Senate Republicans to repeal and replace so-called Obamacare. Now, just today, Senator John McCain announced in a statement that, quote, he cannot in good conscience vote for the Graham-Cassidy proposal. So that brings the bill actually one step closer to perhaps a legislative failure. But earlier this week, Senator Lindsey Graham, whose name is on the bill of South Carolina, he said America faces a very stark choice with Graham-Cassidy, and the choice is this.
So here's the choice for America. Socialism or federalism when it comes to your health care?
Okay, Arlene, socialism or federalism? You decide.
Well, if Medicare is socialism, and it arguably is, then I'm all for socialism. So, you know, when Medicare was first created, the conservatives did in fact call it socialism and viewed it as the worst thing that could possibly be passed in Congress back then. Now people view it as untouchable, though some conservatives would like, in fact, to touch it. So this particular bill would cause so many massive cuts to health care. It would raise costs. It would reduce coverage. It would cut back protections for older Americans and people with pre-existing conditions. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how is the play?
I think Arlene's right that in fact, Medicare really is beloved now, which is exactly the reason that, you know, when Bernie Sanders now starts talking about a single-payer health care system, it's billed as Medicare for all, because it's really just the idea. Well, why not just extend it to more and more groups? But I think that the framing from Lindsey Graham is correct, which is that is a version of socialism. Yes, it is. And what they're proposing, what the Republicans are proposing now, is basically federalism, to put block grants down, let the states do it as they will. Some states are going to win out of that, and other states are going to do really poorly out of it. And I think that's going to be the dynamic playing out politically here. Which states get gored, and do those states have Republicans in them? And if they do, maybe it doesn't pass.
Okay, so this idea that states can do it smarter is one that I asked Julie Rovner earlier this week. She's a longtime health policy reporter. And I said, you know, maybe there is something to that, because here we are in Massachusetts, a state that of its own accord before Obamacare decided to have reach for universal coverage, you know, so-called Romney Care. And she said, well, yeah, maybe states can be a laboratory. But then she reminded us kind of the essentials of what it took Massachusetts to actually get to that near universal coverage.
I was at a conference in Michigan with a bunch of state representatives and a bunch of visitors from Massachusetts, and Michigan was trying to figure out how they could – this was before the Affordable Care Act, but after Massachusetts – and trying to figure out how they did it. And the Massachusetts officials finally kind of looked down and said, well, you know, we had this big pot of money that Senator Kennedy helped us keep. And suddenly all the Michigan officials' sort of faces fell, because it's expensive to cover people with health care. Massachusetts did a very good job, but they also had the money to do it with.
I loved that story, because that is right there for me. That's the reality, that no matter what states try to do, if they really want to try and be bold, it requires assistance from the federal government.
You know, it's exactly right. You know, when I think about this issue, I think about that famous quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, where he said, taxes are the price we pay to live in a civilized society. Well, to me, health care coverage is the price we pay to live in a civilized society. If you want to live in a society that's as civilized as many industrialized nations in the world, you make sure that your people can have health insurance. Jimmy Kimmel had this wonderful tape segment this past week. I really encourage people to go on YouTube and look it up, because he really slammed the bill after having experienced a tremendously painful health problem with his newborn.
Well, we actually have a little bit of Jimmy Kimmel. He's been talking about it all week. This is from a Tuesday night monologue from his show, and here he is.
Most of the Congress people who vote on this bill probably won't even read it, and they want us to do the same thing. They want us to treat it like an iTunes service agreement. And this guy, Bill Cassidy, just lied right to my face. Do you believe that every American, regardless of income, should be able to get regular checkups, maternity care, et cetera, all of those things that people who have health care get and need?
Yep.
So yep is Washington for nope, I guess.
That's Jimmy Kimmel from earlier this week. I want to play one more piece of tape also here. This is Senator Graham again. This links back to something that you were saying, Tom, about who's going to get the money and who's not in the Graham-Cassidy bill. And basically, Senator Graham was saying if any of his colleagues vote against this legislation, they are voting, in his mind, for what is currently an unfair system.
You believe it's okay to help California, New York, Maryland, and Massachusetts more than Missouri. That's just what a Democrat would have to face if they voted no. If you're a Republican and you vote against federalism, you got to explain to people back home why Washington knows better.
Now tell me why that isn't a potent argument in a lot of these states. I think it is.
It's a tremendously potent argument. I mean, the reality is that the states that took Obamacare and ran with it and expanded to coverage are now going to be losers under this. And yes, then the states that did nothing for their citizens would end up winning under the Graham-Cassidy bill. So yes, it's a politically very potent argument, and particularly because a lot of the states that expanded are mostly Democratic states. Mm-hmm. This clearly has elements of this us versus them in terms of the politics of this. The thing is, however, that some of the states that expanded also have Republican representatives.
Right.
And those Republican representatives will be kind of looking at their constituents and saying, so do I really, you know, take money away from my state in favor of some larger national thing, or do I just decide to get reelected?
I know, and when you look at the details of the bill, I mean, even for those states that ostensibly win, everybody loses come 2027.
Exactly.
When the money just stops. It goes away for the expansion money. And then there's that long-term permanent change to all of Medicaid, turning it into a per capita cap system versus sort of the open-ended payments that the federal government does now. Arlene, I just want to ask you also what you make of the politics of this moment, because we were discussing how Chuck Grassley earlier this week admitted He said, you know, to reporters in Iowa, there's 10 reasons why this bill shouldn't even come to a vote. But because it was campaigned on so heavily, Republicans may feel the need to get something passed as a campaign promise.
Well, you know, there are some Republicans that don't believe there should be requirements to cover certain essential conditions, whether it's maternity care or mental health or substance abuse, prescription drugs, whatever it is. I disagree with them, but at least those people are honest. And I can respect their honesty. What I'm troubled with here is that so many of the Republicans are lying to the public and saying, oh, no, this will cover you. And they won't tell people the truth about how many
benefits
they'll
lose. Well,
they're
saying that states can come up with a way to have that covered everybody.
That's right?
Right.
And if you believe that, I'd like to sell you a bridge.
The politics here are kind of incredible to me, because also a little earlier this week, there was this blip of news that saying in order to secure Lisa Murkowski's vote from Alaska, that Senate leadership was contemplating saying that Alaska could be exempt from the Medicaid cuts if at all that was to happen. So sort of vote against Obamacare by getting to keep Obamacare if you're Alaska. I mean, Tom?
No, it's tried and true politics, and it's done on both sides, quite frankly, in terms of making an exception, giving someone else some extra money. I suspect what will happen, though, is that, you know, John McCain's going to start asking the same for himself, and Susan Collins will be asking the same for Maine. And then if it ever gets through the Senate into the House, then you have to add in even more states to getting it. So who knows? Maybe ultimately this is just spending even more than Obamacare.
Yeah. You know, what continuously frustrates me about this whole process is that I think, you know, one place where everyone's in agreement, or most people are in agreement, Republicans and Democrats, is that there are key parts of Obamacare that do need fixing. We talk, you know, till we're blue in the face about stabilizing the individual markets. But for some reason, even when there's a big area of overlap and agreement there, those are not the bills that we're seeing getting a serious push on Capitol Hill.
No, it goes back to the Grassley issue you raised, that certain Republicans say, well, gee, I said that I'd repeal Obamacare, so I have to do it. But the devil is in the details, and the details really matter.
Yeah, I have to say that I'm a little bit annoyed with the Democrats in this one, though, because part of the reason we're not having this bipartisan push is because a whole bunch of Democrats have now, in essence, come out against Obamacare by basically backing the Medicare for All proposal from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and a whole host of others. And we're kind of taking our eye off the ball here by doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, I know a lot of listeners get mad at me when I say that, but they're also invested in not seeing President Trump be successful in anything. So any bill that gets passed that would put Trump's name on it, perhaps they're incented or have an incentive to not help a bill like that along. All right. Well, speaking of the president, I don't even know how to pronounce it. I mean, in the international nuclear weapon wielding name calling game, Kim Jong-un of North Korea has the latest hit here by calling President Donald Trump a dotard. But of course, earlier this week at the United Nations, President Trump had his own name for Kim Jong-un. So let's listen to that.
No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Arlene, I don't know whether to laugh or to cry, but I think I'm leaning towards tears these days.
Yeah, you know, I think his performance was on the world stage was pretty embarrassing. I'm sure his base loved it and he was clearly speaking to them. But the fact of the matter is he wasn't speaking to them. He was speaking to the United Nations. And, you know, some of the other countries have criticized him. Sweden, I think it was, who said it was the wrong speech in the wrong time in the wrong audience. He was speaking like a middle school kid saying, yeah, well, I'll beat you up if you try and beat me up. And it's just, that's fine in the middle school yard, maybe. It's not as fine in the United Nations.
But to Arlene's point, displays of strength are very, very important to Trump's base.
They are. I think it's probably the first time the General Assembly's ever been addressed by a Twitter storm. But it was I've read through the entire speech. It was very disjointed. There were actually places that I liked it. And then all of a sudden it veers off into name calling and bluster. Yes, Donald Trump's base probably really likes this, but on the world stage, and I'm not sure that this really helps in getting us towards some sort of diplomatic solution.
Well, so speaking of diplomatic solutions, let me ask you both this. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like modern history is rife with politicians, having bellicose language, blustering, brinkmanship. But on the other hand, this feels weirdly different. I mean, I don't mean to focus too much on the name calling, but it's deeply, deeply disturbing that
it's immature
on both sides, and both sides have nuclear weapons. I mean,
yeah, you know, I've been watching this week on PBS Ken Burns' miniseries on Vietnam. And learning a lot or being reminded a lot of things that I'd forgotten. And what I'm remembering or learning for the first time is the myriad of mistakes that were made that both led up to the war and then continued it far longer than it could have. And all the people who now admit that they made mistakes, language and culture difference and not thinking about the way our opponents think, bad information, bad judgments. And I fear that while this is not yet analogous, we could be headed that way and then have it exacerbated by a schoolyard bully who doesn't realize when it's time to speak quietly and softly.
Two schoolyard bullies.
You're right.
To be honest.
You're right. One of whom you can't control in North Korea.
Yeah.
But you're stuck with him, and you better understand how he thinks, and you better understand how he approaches a problem, or you can make a calculated decision an uncalculated decision that's dead wrong.
Yeah.
Tom?
I mean... North Korea, obviously, it's just a family issue. We've had three generations and they've kind of, you know, they have created this culture where name calling is part and parcel of whom they are. It really shouldn't be the case for the United States. And I don't think it's probably, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick has always been a better maxim, I think, than start yelling epithets at someone else.
Okay, I'm going to take a deep breath here. And try to put my despair aside. And should we end on a little high note, at least a little more enjoyable note with some hubbubs for this Friday? Okay, Arlene, you first.
All right, I got two quick hubbubs. The first one is to call people's attention to a Beacon Hill Times story about the 19th century church in Boston's Back Bay called the Church of the Covenant, which apparently has the largest intact collection of Tiffany stained glass church windows in the entire United States. They're currently in the process of restoring it, and I, for one, when their restoration is done, intend to go over there. And then maybe as a point of personal privilege, I'll add a Rosh Hashanah greeting, if I may. So for those listeners who don't celebrate this time of year as the New Year's, I'd like to wish you and your listeners a sweet new year of peace, health, and happiness.
Oh, it's wonderful. Your hubbub, Tom?
So here's a below-the-fold story that in years past used to be above the fold. Boston's having an election next Tuesday. Who knew? Well, there's a good reason you didn't know. Hardly anyone is running for office. There will be no ballot for the 4 at-large city council seats. And of the 9 district seats, only 4 have enough candidates to make for an election. True, there are four folks on the ballot for mayor, but only 2 of them, incumbent Marty Walsh and challenger city councilor Tito Jackson, are running serious campaigns. So turnout is undoubtedly going to be very low, and I'm sure we're going to all blame the voters for not being civic-minded enough to go to the polls. But really, to analogize politics to sports, why should fans show up if there are no players on the field?
Well, we have a clown running. for city council.
Do we really?
We do, right?
A real clown? Well, or just...
Pat Payaso, right?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you don't think that
there are some legendary clowns who did serve in the past, too.
Oh, God. All right, so my hubbub is... let me just take a survey amongst the two of you, my scientific, non-scientific survey of two. Do you like daylight savings time? Do you think we should stay on it? What do you think? Yes? No?
It gives us an excuse for being late from time to time, once a year.
So I like the fact that we could do year-round daylight saving time, and I get how cool that would be, but we'd be completely out of sync with New York
exactly.
and every other media right. market. I think it would disconnect us more from the rest of the country, not in favor of it.
So just in case people don't know, there is a state commission, a panel that's looking into moving Massachusetts out of the Eastern Standard Time Zone and into what's known as Atlantic Standard Time. I kind of emotionally like the idea, but practically I'm with you, Tom. Like for 4 months out of the year, if you just wanted to call New York, you'd have to figure out what time it is
right.
in New York or New Hampshire or Vermont or anywhere.
That's right.
Which would be kind of weird. But one man's quixotic quest is how the Globe put it. I think that's a good way. But one man's quixotic quest in Massachusetts may end up actually being state policy.
Hard
so we'll
to
see.
Believe.
I also, for the record, want everyone to know that my director, Jamie Bologna, loves this idea. He wants us to be on Atlantic Standard Time. Well, on that note, it is currently 3:36. We're still on the Eastern Time Zone. Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Thanks so much, Tom.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm a huge Star Trek fan. The Globe's Hiawatha Bray is a huge Trek fan. So imagine our mutual delight when thinking about Sunday's premiere of Star Trek Discovery on CBS. It's a new Trek series. And I should note, it's on the original Trek timeline, not the J.J. Abrams whacked out alternative timeline where the planet Vulcan gets destroyed and hardly anyone blinks. So as far as Star Trek Discovery goes, let me add it. Except for one thing. After Sunday's broadcast premiere, CBS is booting Discovery over to its digital platform, CBS All Access, and you'll have to pay for future episodes. Not cool. In fact, I'm just going to say it. Is CBS acting like one of the greatest Trek villains of all time?
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile.
Oh, well, joining us now to talk about it is Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe. Hello, Hiawatha.
Yeah, hi. That wasn't the Picard recording.
No, that was not Locutus of Borg. That was not
Locutus. No, Locutus. That is one of the greatest episodes in the history of Star Trek.
Two best hours of television I've ever seen in my entire life.
End of season three, beginning
of season four of The Next Generation. Okay.
Well, to tell the truth, I was never a great fan of Next Generation because it was too preachy. I loved the original series. Yes, it was.
Are we going to have a fight about that? You cannot.
And
malign
I also
TNG.
Was partial to Deep Space Nine.
You were?
Because it was darker and more menacing. And one of the producers on that went on to do the greatest science fiction show so far of the 21st century, Battlestar Galactica,
yes.
which was magnificent.
Okay.
Just magnificent.
Well, I mean, as far
but
as...
Never mind.
As far as DS9 goes, there were too many Ferengis on board. I just couldn't deal with it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so back to Star Trek Discovery. What do you think about this idea of CBS allowing on broadcast episode one, but then having to make people, fans, pay to see the rest of the season?
Well, I mean, that's just the way of the world. That's the way things are heading, that multiple channels are being used to distribute television content, and CBS is trying to become a player in the streaming market. And I think it's a perfectly logical thing for them to do. I don't know what its long-term future is going to be. I mean, I don't know. How has The Good Fight been doing? You know what I'm talking about, right?
No.
They currently have the sequel to the TV show, by the way, excellent TV series, The Good Wife, is called The Good Fight.
Uh-huh.
And they are already distributing that on the internet, and I haven't looked at it yet. But if it's as good as the old show, it's probably pretty good. But I don't know what size audience they have. Right now, millions of Americans are watching TV this way, paying subscriptions to look at specific services. And these companies are now fighting like crazy to see who gets the money. You saw what happened with Disney and Netflix, right? You know about that, right? No. Okay.
Educate
Netflix
me.
Netflix was putting a lot of their movies. I mean, I was shocked a couple of months ago. The Star Wars Rogue One, which is one of the best of the Star Wars
showed
movies,
showed up on Netflix. Yes.
It showed up on Netflix because they had a deal with Disney. But now Disney is saying, no, we are going to set up our own service. We don't want to give all that money to Netflix. And so it started, you know, you had companies like Netflix showing videos from other television networks and other movie production companies. And now these guys are saying, no, we want to get it ourselves. HBO has its own. Showtime has its own. Now CBS has its own. And these guys are each trying to make sure that they get the revenue by dividing it up into their own little streams.
Okay, so let me ask you this, because I saw that the head of CBS Interactive said this to Recode, I believe, that the thing, the problem is that on the one hand, yes, Star Trek could actually be a major driver for people being willing to pay for CBS All Access online, but that also they were concerned that he doesn't think that sci-fi shows are generally good for broadcast or historically good for broadcast anymore, that for some reason there's something about the genre that doesn't work on broadcast. And I'm a little confused by that because, I mean, you didn't like The Next Generation, but I adored it for its entire run.
Well, I mean, I think it's a mixed bag. And I mean, I don't know where he classifies The Walking Dead. I would assume that that is sci-fi. I don't know where he classifies Game of Thrones. Oh, I'm sorry. He's talking about broadcast.
Not cable.
He's talking about broadcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, no, in that case, he might have a point. I'm trying to think. Have there been any really substantially successful shows on broadcast that you would classify as sci-fi? I can't think of any.
No, because latest ones that I've loved, like The Expanse, which I'm obsessed with, is on the Sci-Fi Channel. So that's cable.
That's right.
Also.
I haven't gotten to. I've only
and I watched it all entirely online. I didn't even watch it on cable. I watched it online. So
yeah, The Expanse looks quite good. I've only seen about one episode of it, but it is really quite an impressive looking TV show.
Yeah.
So, and sci-fi has done that.
Yeah. So do you think that there's something about science fiction as a genre that is a good driver for moving for getting people to cut the cable, really?
Well, I don't see why not. Star Trek has one of the most loyal fan bases on the planet, if you'll forgive my saying so. I don't see why you couldn't build this around Star Trek as a franchise. It depends on whether or not the show's any good, I think. That's going to be a major driver right there. Look at what The Walking Dead did for AMC. I mean, this was their first... I mean, Mad Men, everybody talked about Mad Men. Everybody loved it. I love Mad Men. Not that many people watched it. Lots of people watch The Walking Dead. Mm. And that really was a stake in the ground for AMC. So it's absolutely possible if the show's good enough. And they have had a really good idea to set the show in the era right before the Kirk-Spock era.
Yeah.
So we find out how the Federation and the Klingons first came to loggerheads. That's a really good place to start. And I mean, that's an inherently interesting subject that could really draw in people like me who really cut our teeth on the original series. If you can capture the feel of the original series, that's really important. Because it was adventurous, it was daring in terms of the seriousness of the stories, but it was also just plain fun.
It was fun.
People forget.
Yeah.
Star Trek was fun.
And funny, also.
Yes, and it was funny. That's right.
I gotta ask you, wait, do you have your phone in there?
Just beaking in the... I'm sorry, you want me to turn it off? I didn't realize.
No,
it just started.
Don't worry about it. You're just a popular guy. Are people, like, texting you a lot?
Yeah, I can't help it. Yeah, it's popping up all over the place. But before we end this, we really should talk about the really... the serious question that all this raises, which is how many of these streaming independent systems are people going to want to sign up for?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you're going to have to separate... if people are talking about cord cutting, but then they turn around and sign up for HBO, they sign up for Netflix, they sign up for CBS. By the time you finish that, you might as well have kept the cord uncut because there are just this almost infinite number of choices now. My wife and I just stumbled across something we found called Walter Presents. All they show are foreign TV series. And she's from Congo. She speaks French. So we've just watched all the French TV shows, and I read the subtitles, and it's great. And that's an incredibly small niche, but it exists. There are hundreds of these little niche streaming sites, and if you start signing up for each one of them, you might as well keep cable.
But No. I'm going to say that there's a difference here, because if the cable companies allowed me to choose my channels a la carte, then I would keep the cable. But for as long as they don't do that, I have no problem with having 35 different individual streaming services and paying for them
individually. Then except the cost. It begins to become ridiculous. And no, you do have another point that I should have made clear. Walter Presents, this one that shows the foreign shows, I couldn't have found that on cable. It doesn't exist anywhere else. That's the big advantage of streaming. Some of these things are stuff you will not get anywhere else. There's this one, I forget the name of it. They're doing movies from the Criterion Collection. You know about that? The company that does classic movie re-releases from the 30s, 40s, 50s. And now they're offering a streaming service for people who love old movies. So you're getting stuff you can't get on cable. And that's why it's going to keep being popular.
Well, Hiawatha Bray, live long and prosper, my friend.
All right, absolutely.
Hiawatha is the tech writer for the Boston Globe. He joins us on Thursdays to debate what's better, DS9 or TNG. TNG wins in my book, and since I'm the host, that's the last word on that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it is officially the first day of fall, and you can feel it. Crisp autumn wind and the changing leaves. And joining us to talk about some of her favorite ways to soak up the season's flavors is Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine and author of the award-winning The Apple Lover's Cookbook. Amy, it is so great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you love about fall?
I have to say, I'm one of those people that goes kicking and screaming into the season. I hate to see summer end, but then fall comes along and I'm dragged along at first, but then you start to experience all those pleasures of the season, the apples and the colors and the smells and also the moods. I mean, I think every season has a certain kind of mood state, and I love that kind of, when that cozy feeling starts to settle in and you make, you know, apple crisp for the first time, or you start to see restaurant menus changing and the food's getting a little, it's good.
You know, for me, I actually love the beginning of fall. Love it, because usually by the end of the summer, I'm done with the heat and humidity.
Yes.
And then, so the beginning of the fall, when the first coolness comes in and the leaves and the transition, I love. And then the middle, I'm less partial to. But then the end of it, I like again, because we're sort of heading into winter.
Yeah.
I guess I just like change points.
Yeah, you do. Well, in September, it really, one thing I think we don't talk about enough, September really is the best month, in my opinion, for eating in New England, because you still have the corn, the tomatoes are really good and ripe, like a lot of our favorite foods are still being harvested, and then we also have some of the fall stuff coming online.
So let's talk about some of the stuff that we can do, right? Because even though we're in fall, it's actually supposed to be in the 70s this weekend, so good weekend to go out. Any events that you're excited about?
Yeah, there's a lot going on this weekend. There's the What the Fluff Festival, which is, they're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the invention of Archibald Query's marshmallow fluff. And that's going to be a really fun day in Union Square. It starts at about 3 o'clock. And, you know, they have fluff musical chairs. They have a burlesque group that's doing, they call themselves the Fluffettes. Flufferettes. They have cooking contests. That's a great one. I'm going to be in Copley Square tomorrow at the Let's Talk About Food Festival.
Yeah.
This is a great event. We're looking at sort of sustainability and thinking about food, you know, where does it come from? How do we consume? But not just here. I mean, there's cooking demonstrations and there's authors signing books and
it's really
a great, like, the full 360 of food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then later on in the season, I'm seeing the Wellfleet Oyster Fest.
That's a great
one. In October.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
And oysters, I mean, eating oysters is actually, you know, beneficial act. Oysters clean our oceans. And the more oysters we eat, the more oysters get planted or nurtured in our seas on these farms. So eat oysters and go to Wellfleet. It's beautiful that time of year. It's very temperate. And then you've got, following up, the Martha's Vineyard Food and Wine Festival is later in October, the 19th to the 22nd. That's a, like, great dine around, really fun crazy food celebration. But one of my favorites is a little lesser known. It's the first weekend of November. It's called Cider Days.
Cider Days, okay.
It's a celebration. Of course, I'm an apple nerd, so I love it. But it's a celebration of New England's apple culture, and especially cider, which hard cider is something we've been drinking from the very beginning of this American experiment. I mean, John Adams drank it every morning for breakfast. And
hard cider,
fermented apple juice, because obviously there's no refrigeration. If you've got some cider, it's going to turn. And this, there are hundreds of ciders from around the world brought together, and you can taste them. You can do workshops on everything from growing apples to making cider to cooking with apples.
Oh, wow. And it's remind fantastic. Where is
so
it
it's out in Franklin County.
Okay.
Deerfield, Shelburne Falls out there. It's just gorgeous.
Oh, great.
So
Cider Days,
event.
First weekend of November.
Every year. And I try to go every year. It's one of my favorite events.
Okay. So there are so many great places to go apple picking that this next question I want to ask you is like pretty, it's very unfair, right? Because we can't possibly name them all.
No.
But what are some of your favorite orchards?
So, yeah, for me, the orchards that really shine are the ones that have a lot of variety of apple because I like to experiment with different, especially heirlooms. My favorite place in the Boston area to go is Neshoba Valley Winery, which is out in Bolton. They have a winery. They make various fruit and grape wines. They have a restaurant on site, but they have a regular orchard with the more familiar varieties, Cortlands, Max, all the things, and you can just show up and go picking. But they also have this heirloom orchard, which you have to actually call ahead and just say, "I'd like to pick the heirloom apples," and they'll say, "Sure." You know, they just need to keep track of who's coming. And they have more than 100 varieties of antique.
100?
100.
Wow.
Apples from France, apples where the flesh is rosy pink inside, apples from England. Ashmead's Kernel is one of my favorites. It dates back to 1700. They have it. So that's where I always have to go every year to sort of get my collection going
again. Terrific. Well, you know, if folks want to go to radioboston.org, we actually put a list of Amy's top six orchards in Massachusetts on the website.
Yeah.
So radioboston.org then again. Okay, so those are teasing me now.
So I brought in some apple treats.
They look so good. Are these cider muffins?
These are apple cider muffins. Cider donut muffins.
Cider donut muffins.
So all the pleasure and flavor of the donut, but none of the frying.
I like the frying.
It's like a lot of work and it's messy and it makes your house smell.
Okay, you talk about it. Okay. I'm going to eat one.
So these are basically a muffin that has concentrated apple cider in the batter. That's the liquid. There's nutmeg.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
Isn't it good? And then when they're done, and so it's like a nice muffin, and then when you're done, but it just has cider in it. When you're done, you brush them with a little butter and roll them in cinnamon sugar, so you get that crunchy exterior like a donut, but you can bake them, and they are...
You have to keep talking.
They are really one of my favorite things to make, and they always convert. Like, it's a conversion experience whenever people make them.
Those are delicious. Okay. Well, I just had a tiny bite there, and I almost just sort of said goodbye to the rest of the segment because I just wanted to keep eating. But we actually have this recipe on our website as well. Again, so run, don't walk to radioboston.org for Amy Traverso's apple cider donut muffins recipe.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. So, Amy, I'm just wondering, one of the great things about New England is that obviously we have deep traditions to draw on here.
Yeah.
But the food scene's also changing. Things are changing. So what trends have you been detecting
recently? One thing I'm excited about, and Boston's always been a seafood town, but I think until the past few years, we felt very wedded to a certain style of, you know, you have to hit your marks. You have to hit your lobster roll, your chowder, your scrod, your baked stuffed shrimp. And then we got Great Bay, which is no longer here, but was replaced by Island Creek Oyster Bar, and started to see a little more experimentation. And I see Boston becoming a seafood town in a new way, a little more innovative. When you think about restaurants like Waypoint in Harvard Square. Mm. Michael Skelf was doing just really interesting. He calls it coastally inspired. He doesn't even say it's a seafood restaurant because I think he wants us to broaden our idea of what that might mean. And then there's a new place, the Mooncusser Fish House, which is owned by the folks who have 80 Thoreau out in Concord, Massachusetts. Uh-huh. This is their first Boston restaurant. And again, you're seeing a little bit less of the I have to do the New England classics and a little bit more global influence. Also, a lot more openness to eating sustainable fish, fish that has not at least yet been overfished. Things like fluke and monkfish and tautog.
I need to display my pescatorial ignorance.
Yes.
Tautog?
Yes. It's a very delicious fish. I mean, it's kind of got a little bit of meatiness to it, but it's not like a really oily. I mean, some people don't like bluefish because it's like very heavy and oily.
I've never seen it on a menu.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, they have it at Mooncusser. They're serving it at Mooncusser right now. And, you know, if we are willing to eat hake and all of these, they used to be called trash fish, not because they were bad.
Yeah.
There wasn't a market for them and there was nothing to do with them. If we expand our horizons as diners, then the fishermen in Gloucester who are going out of business and who are really struggling,
they'll have a market to provide the fish for.
Yeah.
Exactly. So lots of good reasons for sustainability and supporting local fishermen there. We've got about 30 seconds, Amy.
Yes.
For what about maybe a hidden gem further afield?
Yes. There's so much going on outside the city. There are so many great destination restaurants now. I think about like Boston is a city where wealth is accumulating for better or worse. And in California, that happened and they got the wine country. Right. We have, I mean, that it existed before, but it became what it was. We are now starting to get this rural thing. So one place I love, Thompson House Eatery in Jackson, New Hampshire. That's Jeff and Kate Fournier, who used to own 51 Lincoln here in Newton. They've moved. They have a farm. They're raising their own food and they're making incredible food in the White Mountains.
Oh,
there's
fantastic.
A lot of those places.
Jackson, New Hampshire, Thompson House Eatery. Well, Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine and author of The Apple Lovers Cookbook. Thank you so much and happy fall to you.
You too.
And again, at radioboston.org, we've got Amy's list of her favorite orchards and the recipe for these amazing apple cider donut muffins. Make them this weekend. That's it. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.